Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this.
Today's show is going to be a bit different, but then again, these days, is anything normal? A little over 2 weeks ago, a group of creative, innovative people gathered in an online meeting to answer a simple question. What could they do to help the frontline workers in the battle against COVID-19? Supplies of personal protective equipment for healthcare workers, long-term care homes, first responders, and others was in jeopardy. These are essential for safety and to keep these critical people at work so the rest of us can be safe. So what could be done? The results was an unprecedented collaboration between talented people, dedicated volunteers, generous companies, and caring individuals to meet the local demand. The results are astonishing, showing not only that people can work together, but they can also overcome and adapt in the face of incredible challenges. This is their story, told by those inside on behalf of the many who have stepped up to meet the challenge within Northumberland. It is not only a story about logistics, innovation, and hard work, but also one of caring and generosity, two words that are continuously repeated these days when talking about the community spirit demonstrated by all involved. First, you will hear from Chris Gillis, Manager of Applied Research and Business Development of Durham College. He will describe how one of his colleagues got out in front of this idea to create protective equipment on a small scale to meet local demand. He will then tell us how Northumberland picked up on this idea and pushed forward. Then, in the second segment, you will hear from Wendy Curtis, Executive Director of the Community Futures Development Corporation and Venture 13, along with Brian Reed, a Coburg industrialist. They will tell the story from a different perspective. This time, you will hear how the genesis of the collaborative group actually started more than a year ago, and from that foundation emerged something called the Northumberland IO Producer Alliance, a coming together of manufacturers, engineers, producers, and an army of volunteers working in buildings, garages, basements, and back rooms to create the parts for a range of personal protective equipment for Northumberland. So let's begin with Chris Gillis at Durham College. He's an interesting bridge. While he works at Durham, he also works closely with Venture 13, and he lives in Coburg. Here's my interview with Chris Gillis. Could we begin by you telling me the story about how all this got started?
This is really kind of a journey of where a community sort of ignited around really sort of an urgent need and worked together really innovatively to develop processes and pull everyone together, protocols, to really try to address that need. So
did it begin by a conversation? Was it a phone call? How did it all get started?
There's been a number of different things happening here, and I know from a Durham College point of view, and I am a Coburg resident, and I've been sort of working along to support a lot of the work happening at Venture 13, so we had connections here. But of course, one of Durham College's faculty, Chris Daniel, had started a GoFundMe campaign because his wife is a public health nurse, and he wanted to get face shields basically out to people, the frontline workers. And I think what happened is a number of these things started to come alive all at once. And I would say we probably got, might have been an email or a call. I forget exactly who, probably John Aiden at Venture 13. Indicating that, as a community, the Venture 13 CFDC out here wanted to pull everyone together and really respond to a need that really frontline healthcare workers and needed this protection. And what started to become really evident is that frontline workers are more than just people in hospitals, nurses, very, very important group. But we started to hear about PSWs in long-term care facilities and all of that sort of a thing. So there was a very significant need, and really what that wasn't being met. Probably no one's fault. I'm not sure where that's all going to come out in the end, but we knew that there needed to be something happening. And so Venture 13, because of the good relationship that I'd had and Durham College has had in supporting efforts, asked us to be part of this whole group that they termed the Northumberland. I think it was the Makers. Let me just see. That's not the Makers. It's the Northumberland Producer Alliance. And so they pulled a whole variety of people together. And if you see the press release, which you probably have, I just printed a copy off, but there's a lot of organizations on there. So Venture 13 pulled the group together, and there's been a lot of collaboration to make shield parts and assemble them. I know Durham College has printed headbands, and that's been predominantly our role, but we've also been able to source some of the face shield material to also supply. But we have in Venture 13, like the Microfactory people are in fact, and Colin Slade working with them, actually assembling these shields and distributing them to both the hospital here. I think there's been distribution to some of the long-term care facilities and others. It's hard to keep track. Things are happening so quickly. So that's kind of how I recall this thing sort of coming together.
Now, can you help us better understand? I mean, a face shield, we see pictures of them on social media and the news at night, and photographs. What exactly makes up a face shield? How many parts does it have, and what is necessary to create one of those?
Right. Good question. And I think what you'll see is people look out there that there are a number of different designs. And the one that was picked for production here was one that was developed in the Czech Republic called Prusa. And it happens to be a design that was approved in Europe. And I think we just gravitated towards it because it was one that could be simply produced on available 3D printers. We knew it had approval in Europe. And I think we're hoping, assuming that as Health Canada gets a better grasp on things, they will also approve that or with certain modifications. But what makes up that particular shield is predominantly four parts. Well, let's see, one, two, three. Yeah, there is a clear plastic face shield, obviously, that provides sort of the outer shell protection to sort of a frontline worker who would probably also want a mask on underneath it. There is a headband that holds the shield. Sometimes there's a small sort of rigid piece at the bottom to keep the shield curved. And then typically there's some sort of an elastic portion or elastic band that would allow the face shield to fit more comfortably and adjust to different head sizes on different workers' heads. And so you've got those different components, and that typically makes up the shield part. But of course, healthcare workers would want to have, you know, face masks and other types of protective equipment as well. This is just sort of that initial odor armor, if you will.
So describe then the technology and the process of creating the masks.
Really interesting. Typically, you need specific software design files, which in this case, part of the reason the design was picked was they were freely available and downloadable, shared widely. And so, printers here in Northumberland were then able to get a hold of those design files. And what you then have to do is have one of these things called a 3D printer, which is a really interesting sort of exponential technology that allows you to basically use a plastic material in this case, and it heats it up, melts it, and it then in three dimensions will actually follow this design file and create a part, or depending how large it is, could do several parts at one time. And so that's how the headbands are typically made. At least this is what's happening here in Northumberland. And then we need to actually source the clear shield piece. Typically those are, sometimes you can get them pre-cut, but very frequently you need to actually cut them yourself, or maybe laser cut them. But again, another piece of technology that then produces a shield that can snap on, sort of a nipple or something like that, on the head shield itself. And then you actually get the elastic that is then strung on the back. And so what we have here are really cool, really a distributed network. So all through Northumberland, there are people printing these headbands. And this is also an area that Durham College has been able to contribute, because we, at the same time, we're building our own substantial network. And we've then been able to allocate some of what we've made here. So you now have these headbands, the people out of Venture 13, so that's, I think, what the Microfactory and Colin have been doing, are actually now assembling these, which means snapping the face shields on the headbands and then putting the elastic band on. And sometimes they will sanitize them with like an alcohol rub and then actually package them in like a bag, a plastic bag. And then these are collected. And then from there, someone would then distribute those to the different locations that really need them. And I think if you're on the website, you'll see pictures at different places there that show some of the different frontline workers receiving some of the face shields. And depending on how large they are, they might need just a few, or they might need quite a number. So that's kind of how that works.
Now, I noticed that there's talk that this is going on 24/7 right now. How many people are actually involved in this, and how many facilities?
That's a good question. You might have to ask John Hayden a little bit more about the total number here. I know in the Durham network we have about 50 people printing. I would think it's probably getting close to that here. And then you have some of the assemblers who are working out of Venture 13 and, you know, obviously have to have social distancing. So there's a small crew there putting that together. But I don't know if it actually has on the site, but it does actually list, you know, all of the partners. So you can start to see there's a...
Yeah, there's about 22 partners. And it's really interesting too, because there I saw the Coburg Police, the Town of Coburg, even Watershed Magazine. How are organizations like the police and the town and Watershed, how are they contributing?
Specifically on specific roles, you'd have to maybe talk to Colin about exactly what he has them doing there. Beyond the people obviously printing, there are people who need to help source raw materials. And so we have that. We have people who are distributing.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different roles in here. And I apologize.
Not at all.
I don't know the details.
Not at all, Chris. This is very helpful. I'm interested, though. I mean, you've talked about a lot of people. How is all this being coordinated? I mean, you know, all these different factors, how do you pull them all together so that it comes together and it flows?
Well, as I said, there are people in there, fulfilling sort of lead roles. Again, Brian Reed, a very important one there. Colin Slade around the manufacturer. Wendy Curtis and John Hayden of CFDC. And again, we rely on another technology. I can't tell you how many video meetings I've been on the last week out here and other places, people just pulling together, meeting all throughout the day virtually to really organize themselves to be able to do all the things that are needed. And then you have all the guys printing all these bits and parts and stuff like that. So it's really quite astounding when you, and this is a personal opinion, I know we hear an awful lot about this being an unprecedented crisis, which it is for sure. But what I also think is, to me, a really positive side of all this is the response is also unprecedented. It's the first time we've ever had the internet and video conferencing and the 3D printing, these technologies available to us to get instant communication and to do things that we normally could never ever do. So I see that as, to me, one of the very positive things about what's happening, certainly in this community, and I think probably in communities across Ontario and Canada as we respond to this crisis.
So how is all this being paid for then?
Well, I believe that CFDC has some money that has been put into this. I do know that a GoFundMe campaign by the Producers Alliance has started. Durham College's Chris Daniel had started a GoFundMe campaign initially when he started his. And just to give you an idea of how how effective they can be, I think in the space of about a day and a half, it went from $430 to like $9,000. And that's just to the generosity of people in Durham and Northumberland donating to these causes. And so that's been helpful. We're also getting, some other parks, and a lot of time is donated. I would think that, and again, I don't know, but I would think that all of these companies and organizations listed in the press release, they're fundamentally donating their time and probably materials in that they have to pitch in and do their part in all of this.
Now, Chris, this, in a bigger picture, speaks to the ability of Canadian manufacturers to pivot. What does this tell us about the manufacturing sector in this region?
I think a lot. I mean, one, just to be able to see the willingness to pull together is really a tremendous asset. And I think what it does is it really tells us that, you know, as Canadians and as our manufacturers in the region and local areas really have that ability to respond rapidly. And again, you know, it's the availability of these technologies that we've never, ever had really before in any sort of worldwide or crisis like this. There was all that sort of a bit of that news about U.S. potentially blocking supplies here and things. And, you know, I think what it says is we're pulling together to really act as Canadians, Ontarians, to really really be self-sufficient and address the needs that we have as a region, as a country.
And is it my understanding correct that this initiative that you guys started, you were one of the first or the first to sort of break out and start doing this?
I think it's fair to say that Durham College was certainly among the first, but a lot of these things happened in parallel. And I think because of the strong support and relationship between Durham College and Venture 13, and we had a very trusted and productive sort of relationship, we were asked initially in the beginning to be one of the initial participants to work with, local companies and people out here. And we're just, really proud and happy to be supporting this whole initiative in this area that is really just focusing on getting these this equipment, personal protective equipment, to frontline workers in our area.
Now, in doing this, will it have an impact on manufacturing in the future?
Yeah, I think for sure. As we look at this, there is going to be significant economic impact, as we get through this and as we start to return to some sense of normality, if I can use that term. Our manufacturers who have pitched in may experience shortages and things, and I think we really need to be looking at how we can continue to support them as they start to shift back to what their normal sort of lines of business has been. So I think that's an immediate one, but I would also say that potentially, and this is just this really positive side of me looking forward, that if we learn some lessons now about the things that we have done, I think potentially we can come out of this much stronger and really have a much better sense of how our manufacturers could organize and operate in a distributed manner to do things that they normally could not have done before. Because my guess is, and I don't know, but as I look at the list again on the press release, I'm guessing in the past, the normal course of life, a lot of these organizations might not have had an awful lot to do with each other just because of the lines of business they're in. Now, starting to understand what this new sort of a distributed model is capable of, I think it potentially opens up an awful lot of interesting things where both with sort of out of Venture 13 and what CFTC and the town of Kopergrim police are doing here, we can start to maybe develop much more innovative approaches that utilize our existing businesses and manufacturers in ways we'd never really thought about before.
What goes through your mind? This is my last question. What goes through your mind when a celebrity movie actor gives you a shout out on social media?
Well, I guess the first reaction is, wow, because we're not used to having that sort of thing happen, right? It's not part of our daily lives. But I think what it's really great to see, because we now see that these people who are in a position that have a lot of, I'll say, online influence are, focusing on what is happening at a local community level and pointing at that, saying, hey, job well done. I think that's really a great thing. And I think, we do in a lot of these have a lot of unsung heroes, people who, as you said, are working 24/7, working around the clock, working weekends to really do this and respond. And although a lot of them, that's not obviously why they're doing it, but I think, saying thank you is a really good thing to do. And I think it's maybe something we need to stop and do a little more of as we all move through this.
Well, I'd also like to thank you very, very much for talking to me today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Rob.
That was Chris Gillis, Manager of Applied Research and Business Development on the Whitby campus of Durham College. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will hear another side of this story about how a local retired industrialist and Venture 13 pulled together a group of talented innovators, along with some dedicated caring volunteers, to build a micro-manufacturing operation to supply the demand for personal protective equipment in Northumberland. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. Headlines flash across North America. 3M, the largest manufacturer of protective masks, is being asked not to send supplies to Canada. Amidst the political fallout, healthcare workers and those on the front lines express grave concern about their ability to do their jobs safely. Meanwhile, locally, the call goes out for help. A retired local industrialist, Brian Reed, and Wendy Curtis, executive director of the Community Futures Development Corporation and Venture 13, are holding meetings. Chris Gillis, whom we met in the last segment, is part of this. This group decided to take action. They believed there can be a response to meet the need here in Northumberland. Here is my interview with Brian and Wendy as they tell us how within 2 weeks, a micro-manufacturing company is born using people from all kinds of backgrounds and skills working remotely from sourcing materials to the people assembling the final products. You will discover how a diverse group can become singular in purpose and action. Here are Wendy and Brian. I am truly pleased to have with me online Wendy Curtis, who is with Venture 13, and I have Brian Reed, retired Coburg industrialist. Welcome both to Consider This.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Let's start with you, Brian. How did this all start for you?
I think for me, it was Mukesh Bhagari had
contacted, and I think Wendy had put together a group of us a long time ago to talk about helping the hospital be more innovative. So we had a team of six or seven that met probably a year or so ago and got to know each other. So when the issue came up, Mukesh contacted us and said, could we help, and gave us some of the things he was needing to help at the hospital and the community. So I guess it started a year and a half ago, but really 10 or 12 days ago is when this project itself started. We originally were talking about different things around mental illness and challenges that were being seen in the community and how we could help with that.
So Wendy, from your perspective, a year and a half ago, tell us about this conversation and what inspired you to want to bring this group together.
Well, at the time, we were, just as Brian said, we were talking more about, not about this initiative, but rather how can we leverage Venture 13 and some of the activity there, along with others in the community, to work in innovative manners to find solutions in whatever the challenge of the community was. So we began to talk a little bit about how partners could align to try and support some of the challenges that the hospital system was facing. And so that's how we kind of all, from the broader perspective, got to know each other a little bit. And so if we fast forwarded to this situation, what I think was when I listened to Brian talk, what I hadn't actually thought about it like that, Brian, but the reality is this was about relationships. So established quite some time ago. So we have a new need. It's a very urgent, unprecedented need. And the relationships just reach out to each other. And this has been about the activity of the last couple of weeks has been like absolutely amazing in terms of people just leaning on each other and leaning in to try and work together in a very fluid situation. And I would suggest that really what we're really doing is working as partners, working as relationships to continue to innovate and find a solution for the community in the short term.
So Brian, could you walk us through then the steps for this collaboration?
Well, Rob, I guess days-wise, was it the 1st of April, 2nd of April, something like that, where a Zoom call was put together by Wendy and John Hayden, and they asked me to step in and try to coordinate, having been in manufacturing and run a facility in Coburg and Mexico. I was able to bring some of my supply chain into the mix, although not that strong on the sewing side, but on the plastic side, I had a lot of contacts. So I kind of sat in the middle with all these experts and pulled the different items that they needed. You know, you have all these 3D printers coming in, and we want to do a big shout out to them, Rob, because there are people all over the county producing 3, 4, and 5 headbands and driving them to our drop-off spot. So what I did is I kind of turned it into a company rather than just, well, I don't want to say just. We had a lot of people meaning a lot of goodwill in trying to do it. They just needed to coordinate who was going to do what. So we picked out some guys, gave them some jobs, and everybody raised to the level, and the cooperation has been spectacular. I don't think there's been one call where anybody wouldn't do something. Some people are uncomfortable depending on their, you know, their breathing and their age and that being in contact, but those people are doing phoning and helping purchase and buy and find supplies. So I guess I was the logistician in the middle, trying to pull all of these skilled technical people together.
So what were some of the challenges as you got started?
So when we first started talking, it was right towards the end of March. And the big thing was, at that point, was some stability in supply chain. And so part of what we did, and Brian's right, I think it was April 1st or 2nd or somewhere in there, we put together a bunch of people that were really interested and already sort of started things. But what we said was, okay, we need to make this a little bit more like established processes and systems, which is where Brian was like brilliant at in terms of looking at this from small scale manufacturing and test that for a week or so and see, like, how do we pivot? How do we change? What do we need to do here, there? Like, where do we have to get supplies and so on? And Brian and his team were working very effectively in the background to do those kinds of things. And so we probably went, we being the collective we probably went for a week, 8 days or so, producing before we were very confident to be able to come out to the community, because, you know, we didn't want to disappoint the community. And whether we've got 50 or 100 per day or whatever, we wanted to be confident that we had something that the community could count on going forward and not be up and down all over the place. So there was a massive amount, like, I can't even believe, extraordinary. It's just almost unbelievable the work that went on for about 8 days to get to the point that we could actually go out with confidence and invite a community to actually benefit from this. So,
Brian, can you help us better understand when Wendy's talking about supply chains and bringing these elements together, can you describe those challenges and just so that the everyday person might have a better understanding of what it was you're facing as you're trying to pull this all together?
Okay, so, you know, from a high level, you've got a number of volunteers and the community is huge and everybody would like to do something. We had to kind of figure out who could do what and who was better suited for another job. And if you think about a business, we had to have a manufacturing line. We had to have supply of sheet. We had to have supply of 3D print headbands. We had to have buttonhole picked up and brought in so you could hold these face shields to the first responders heads. So what we basically did is we had somebody in charge of logistics, somebody in charge of distribution, somebody in charge of QC, somebody in production, and somebody in purchasing. And each one of those people, being a volunteer, was tasked with a certain amount of work. And although we crossed over, we all tried to stay in our lanes the best we could to support each other. And the supply chain, when we talk about that, it's like elastic band, which you think should be pretty easy to get in normal situations. Well, they're not critical factories, so they're shut down. So we're actually calling people at companies like Fabricland. District managers are going into the back and tossing their materials out the back to give to us so we can keep the line going. So quite different than placing an order and it shows up in 48 hours. It was more like, who has it? Who will drive and get it? Who will bring it back? All in the backdrop of all these places are closed. So when we say supply chain, we're talking about all of the items that come to make the product, which seems fairly simple. It's thin sheet, it's 3D printed material, it's elastic band, and all of those keep going critical. As of an hour ago, the CEO of Fabricland just emailed me and said, we're going to get you more buttonholes. So now we can potentially move our production up because we could only produce at the rate that we could get the material. Any one of those supply chains goes down and we're making 3/4 of a face shield, which is useless to anybody if it won't stay on their head. So we have to manage that whole grouping. SABIC has stepped up and they're going to give us like 122 sheets today. So those are real live numbers that allow us now to start to plan volunteers and assembly lines and the rest of the program. But without the materials, we can't do anything. So big shout out to Canadian Wear Tech, who has been doing a lot of work for us also with their people. Supply chain is the raw material, but it's also the labor that we can to put it together.
It reminds me a lot, I was going to say, of somebody juggling. And you've got all these balls in the air, and if any one of those balls doesn't fall in the right place, or you don't catch it, or you don't throw it hard enough, then you can't juggle anymore. So it really sounds complicated. But at the same time, what seems phenomenal about this is that this isn't a company that already exists. This is just a group of people who are collaborating in very different ways. How many people would you say, Wendy, are involved with this, and how many facilities are being coordinated to make this all happen?
Geez, Brian, you may have to help me with this, but I would think there's a, in terms of people, we must be approaching 100 people, I would say, easily. And in terms of facilities being coordinated, it's got to be at least 30, isn't it, Brian?
I'm not sure what you mean by facilities. I can talk to people and it, you know, everything from the police chief putting these on and telling us, will they fall off the heads of the first responders? all that data is somebody or two or three people doing something to feed back to us to tell us, yes, this is good or isn't good, all at the same time as producing. So you might have 50, 60 people just producing the headbands. You've probably got 30 people at different stages, either assembling or driving or picking things up. So you would be right in that number, 30 different facilities and over 100 people. We can't forget all these ladies that are now sewing to help extend our buttonhole. Incidentally, I never knew what buttonhole was 8 days ago. So I've learned a lot on this, but Teresa Craig has a bunch of ladies that are sewing fabric to our buttonhole. So instead of using 12 inches, we're only using 6 inches. So now we can double the volume of items we can produce. So there's a lot of these things going on that you don't even know. People are just jumping up and doing them.
I wonder to what extent, though. I mean, it's interesting what you just said. How much have you learned through this process, Brian? I mean, you've been in manufacturing for a long, long time, and I'm sure you've seen a lot. And yet, you just said, you know, you're learning at the same time. How much is this is new to you? And
well, there's a couple of new things you can imagine. I've got like a $10 billion company like SABIC supplying a charity line with, you know, three guys that can work 2 hours from noon until 2 in the afternoon. So you've got a huge diversity of where people are coming from. And I realized everybody has certain barriers that they can't get around, whether it be corporate structure, whether it be one person has a blind mother at home, so they have to be home for it by a certain time. So I'm learning a lot about how committed our community is. And I don't want to, you know, compare small community Ontario to big community, but I hazard a guess it would be very difficult for me to do this in a town that had 1 million people. But in a town that has 18,000, and you know, you include Port Hope and Northumberland County and the guys in Durham, most people know most people. So if they can't do it, you're not left stranded. They call somebody and they get back to you within 20 minutes saying, yes, I have a driver and I can pick it up. So the biggest thing I've learned is that the people in the community are spectacular. We're very, very fortunate to live where we do.
Wendy, can you help us understand the role of Venture 13?
Okay. Well, first of all, Venture 13 is a municipal building owned by the town of Cobourg, and it's actually closed right now. But I say that loosely. It has prime tenants, which include many entrepreneurs and the CFTC, which I run, but also the Maker Lab is there. And the Maker Lab is an area where there's combined equipment to be able to do stuff. And the primary users of the Maker Lab are Northumberland Makers, which are, I don't know how many strong, but these are volunteers in the community that come in and use the equipment and they create stuff. There's also Canada's, to my knowledge, Canada's first cooperative, micro factory cooperative that is a fairly new organization. It's less than a year old. And that's a for-profit organization. And they share the space at the Maker Lab. So in terms of Venture 13, Venture 13 is all about, as you know, innovation. And to me, it's the right spot to be assisting all of these different organizations to work together to move this forward. I mean, as we've mentioned, the pace has been breathtaking. It really has been. And so when we got to the point where we were fairly confident that the supply chain was maybe a little shaky, but ready to go. And when we got to the point where we're ready to go out to community, that's where the CF kind of stepped in with some of our skills. For every 100 you have, how do you select who gets, you know, the first 99 or whatever? Like, there had to be a process developed. And so we pitched a process to, it was only last Thursday, by the way, like it's all, I can't even believe it. We pitched to the leaders, including Brian and others that were been on the call, who had been working very hard for the previous week or so to get the production side. And we pitched, well, why don't we just consider it parity? So we'll group every organization into four kind of buckets, and they all have equal parity. And so we defined the buckets as being the hospital, and long-term care is the second one, emergency response workers is the third, and then finally essential workers. And so those are the people we wanted to try and get to help first. And so in the same time, we needed some sort of system to be able to manage all that. And that's where the CF, I think, working with our website designer, John Charlton, and they worked all weekend to prepare the website for public launch on Monday, is the framework for the community to come in and actually make their orders. And then others, which has nothing to do with us, the team that's busy fulfilling and doing all of that stuff, they just pull all the orders off daily and they fulfill based on that 25, 25, 25, 25 model. And we may end up changing that model, but we wanted to go out with parity in that way.
Now, can you help me understand too the relationship, Wendy, between yourselves? I've talked to a representative from Durham College, and I know they're participating. And I also talked to another person who's at OUIT, and I know they're doing some other things, not as deeply, but they're also on the periphery of this as well. Can you just help us better understand how these organizations are meshing in with this initiative that's happening here in Northumberland?
Okay, so Brian, I know we'll probably have some other views too, but we were very fortunate to have the people at Durham College step up. I mean, Durham College has a rep that's at Venture 13 on a regular basis. So that was the one, Chris Gillis. And he was a wonderful conduit to Chris Daniels, who is a professor at Durham College, who's doing some similar work in primarily like emanating from Durham. And he was extraordinary to help us to understand some of the issues, some of the things we should watch. I mean, remember, we've built this business in less than 2 weeks. So we kind of leaned on him. He was another partner who came along and gave us his critical learning, basically, so we could leverage that. And then in addition to that, he's got a whole team of students and others in that area that are 3D printing some of the components, and they've contributed some of those components to this effort as well. So we found, like, we just leveraged their knowledge already. They were a few days ahead of us, and they were very generous and compassionate to our needs as well. And I don't know, Brian, if you want to add more to that.
Well, for sure. Sure, I can add. I can say that a lot of the students that go to Durham come out of Northumberland area as well as Durham area, and those students should have a big shout out, because we can send a file to Chris and he can start printing that night 3D headbands, which is looking to become our next critical path now that Buttonhole is done and Plastic Sheet is done. So Durham College and some of the people in the Makers Lab and that have 3D printers, we're asking anybody else who has one to please go on the site and let us know so we can give them the file and they can start printing. But for sure, Chris Daniels and Chris Gillis have been on the phone on all our Zoom calls and have been valuable resources. As a production guy, I'm looking at the numbers and saying, I appreciate the 500 odd headbands that they promised me for next Monday. Mm-hmm. Again, that's the supply chain, right? We go right back to that, because without it, we have nothing. And they have a pretty good system there for pickup and collection. So it's not as onerous of picking up 2 in Orono and 3 in Toronto and 5 in Newcastle. We have a pickup point and we have a driver that meets them there once a week. And what they have from the students, what they have, even through their exams, some of these students are printing and they're also trying to get through their year. So big shout out to them.
Now, there's been some talk back and forth about the capacity of this project and how many it can produce. Can you give us just some numbers so that we can appreciate just what's being produced and then what the target is?
Can I just say that, and I know Brian's probably better at but when we launched on Monday, we were confident that we could tell the community at that point that we were at 77 per day. And that's from 0 2 weeks ago. Now it's Wednesday, less than 48 hours later, we're up to 100 per day. And it's a very fluid situation, because what's happening here is, as Brian mentioned, if you were to go onto the website, Rob, you would see that there's provision for several things on there. There's provision for you to order as one of those four buckets, as I call them buckets, but you can order. And on the website, the other thing that's on there is that there's so many in the community that want to support this. So we have provision on the website for if I happen to have a 3D printer at home and want to be part of this, I can, you know, quickly say that, and I can type it, send it, in I go, and I can say, I got my 3D printer, can I be part of this? And then there's another side that'll follow up with that, pick it up, which is also helping to take the 77 to 148 hours. There's many in the community that maybe don't have a 3D printer, but they were quite amazed at the level of interest by the community to actually donate on a GoFundMe page, which has been set up. And that's rapidly growing. I think in less than 48 hours, they're up to $3,500. And those dollars will be used to support all the stuff that the components that Brian mentioned, like I don't even know them all myself, but, and I think that's crucial because that's helping to sustain the supply chain. And if there happens to be funds left over, it's a very simple thing. Those will be scooted out to our two local hospital foundations, so the community will ultimately benefit from that as well. So, and even the website is being built now. I mean, it's live, and we are evaluating how can we improve that in the same way as the production. I mean, while they've been producing, they've actually, with a super eye in a very fluid situation, they're continuously improving that. And that's going to continue, I would say. Brian, you probably want to add to that because you are extraordinary at that.
I'm happy to add to that. I hate to be a broken record, but our limiting factor is really not our production number. We could go up. We wanted to go at a rate that we didn't disappoint our volunteers. They're showing up and have nothing for them to do. So we could supply on our critical path about 70, 75 a day with that, what I said, the elastic band. With what I think we have now, we could double or triple our production. Can we physically do it with all the volunteers? That I don't know. Remember, we have social distancing. We only let two or three people in on the assembly line a day. So if we went for 8 hours, let's say, and we did 40 an hour, we could go to, you know, 320 masks a day. I don't know if we would be able to sustain it from sheets. For sure we could sustain, then it comes down the headband. So we're probably, with this call, if it goes out, if people have 3D printers and they come online, that will determine how many we can do per day. But I could easily see, if we could mobilize 25 or 30 more printers, we could get up to 300 a day.
Now, in terms of financing, Wendy, you mentioned earlier that there is a possibility for donations, but how is all this being financed at the moment?
We started off with one person just paying for what we needed so we could go. CFDC came up and offered, I'll let Wendy tell you about that. And then the GoFundMe page came. So we had a lot of requests from people who couldn't come and make things. They had children at home. They had elderly people. They didn't feel comfortable and they wanted to do something. So it was Wendy's genius to go with a GoFundMe page. But we did start with one individual, then a help from Wendy's group, and now the GoFundMe. And I think we're all putting something in along the way. Is that about it, Wendy?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, it's a matter of understanding that, you know, we had some private support to kickstart the thing to make sure it actually worked. And then along the way, we migrating, and it's still in a parallel manner. The CF, as you know, has funds available to support economic development and innovation. And so we felt it important to actually have, it's not a large sum, but a little bit to actually help. So most of that will probably end up being spent behind acquisition of more 3D printers and to support the effort.
Do we have a number?
5,000.
Okay, well, on the financial thing, just to be clear, many of the manufacturing guys are donating their sheets and their time. So the costs have been borne by a lot of the manufacturers too. In other words, SABIC is not asking us to pay for the sheets that are donated. Canadian Wear Tech is donating. So there's a lot of donations. It's the secondary items that we can't get donated outside our community, although some have been.
What is this experience telling us about the ability of Canadian manufacturers to pivot?
I think that we're And if you think of what the premier said, he'll never be caught again without the ability to make things. The manufacturers are few and far between compared to, you know, 30 years ago, 35 years ago when I was in the manufacturing business. So they are working hard. They're struggling in their own business, and they're giving us a very generously of their time. But we need to increase the manufacturing base out there, and we need to make our own stuff and stand on our own 2 feet in Canada. We can't depend on other nations to make our stuff at a reduced price. I think we've gone the China / low-cost country route, and as a result, we found ourselves in some bad situations when push came to shove.
Now, Brian, when we look at this incredible collaboration and all the moving parts, the speed at which it's been done, the spirit of the people that have come together, what impact is this going to have on manufacturing in this area in the future?
Well, I guess, I mean, the commitment by the province to source from Ontario, it's clear that the cost of manufacturing in North America is much greater than a low-cost country. So I think, you know, there's an opportunity for entrepreneurs to, you know, try to build companies before. But you got to realize that if a company has been in business and they've lost their business to China, it's very hard for them to come back and invest and try to build again without some type of way to guarantee their product would be sold or at a level that they could maintain a business. And I've always said profit in business isn't a dirty word. It's something that has to be there so they can reinvest in their companies. And I think the ones that went by the wayside was because anything that can be shipped across the ocean cheaply can't cost effectively be made in the more expensive developed countries. I think you're going to see critical items being resourced in Canada by some of the critical issues that are needed. I don't know if that's gloves. I don't know if that's masks. I don't know what it is.
But I also wonder too, though, this ability to pivot so quickly, to collaborate in such an incredible way, for all these disparate elements to come together. Is it showing us a new path in terms of how manufacturing can take place and the levels of cooperation that can occur in order to meet the demand?
For sure. With a common goal like COVID-19, the people rallied very, very tightly. So there is that collaboration and the business of while that they talk about, where while I'm at work, I can have my printer print something, so I can have a business. So yeah, definitely the whole world will never be the same as it was pre-COVID and post-COVID, and manufacturing will feel that effect. So yes, for sure, your comment is right on.
Wendy, last question. What goes through your mind when a celebrity movie actor gives you a shout out on social media?
This is a bit embarrassing, but I wasn't exactly sure that was. But, you know, I look at it more of at a local level. We have an incredible energy and passion and people that are working together to do a local solution for a local need right now. I don't think these folks ever expect, like, at some point, Canadian manufacturers will fill the need in the market, but that's not today. That is coming in the near future. We understand that. But I know that these people, all these volunteers, and even people at the CFTC, or, you know, you kind of look at it. And let me leave by saying that there's an order that came in the other day, and two very powerful words were at the bottom of the order. And they were very simple. They said, please help. And if that isn't enough motivation for people, I don't know what, like, this is people helping each other. And that's one of the most unifying and gratifying. My God, it's the right thing to do. So I'm very proud to be part of this. And it's not, we didn't do it. I mean, we're just trying to support the effort. And it's just a very special thing to be involved in.
I want to thank you both for taking the time out of your incredible busy days to talk to me. Thank you so much. That was Wendy Curtis, Executive Director of the Community Futures Development Corporation and Venture 13, along with retired industrialist Brian Reed. If you would like to help or donate to this enterprise, it can make a difference. They are looking for more 3D printers, buttonhole supplies, drivers, and assemblers. The more who help, the easier it is to meet the local demand. To get more information, Google Northumberland.io. The website has all the information you will need, from how to sign up to assist, right through to how to donate. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more from Consider This.